The next case is 09-2302, Cincinnati Bar Association versus Paul Joseph Kellogg. Mr. Rosenwald.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, counsel. I am Peter Rosenwald, representing the Cincinnati Bar, the relator in this particular case. It is the position, quite simply, of the Cincinnati Bar and the relator that the recommendation of the Board of Commissioners is inadequate under the facts and circumstances of this particular case. Ordinarily, I suppose, when you appear before this court, you argue case law and say this case holds this and this case holds that. And I think that is true. We've cited a half a dozen cases that say that permanent disbarment is the appropriate remedy when there has been a federal felony conviction. However, rightly so, the respondent has cited a number of cases where this case is determined that even though there has been a conviction, be it a federal felony or a state felony, that permanent disbarment is not the appropriate remedy. And then, as recently as last month, this court released a decision where the middle ground, where there was an indefinite suspension. So rather than talk about cases, I'm going to talk about why we think that the board has misconstrued the facts and misinterpreted them and then reached the wrong conclusion. One of the problems with the board's recommendation from a realistic standpoint is that as of today, the 18 months of actual suspension, I'll call it, 14 and a half months would have been served. Almost 10 and a half months of it were served while the respondent was in custody in the federal system. I don't know when this court will reach a decision, but potentially that entire 18-month period of time, since there's only 3.5 months left, will be over, and he will be into the I'll call it probationary period, although the board didn't really say it would be probation. The only condition that came from the panel is that he follow the rules of supervised release in federal court.
How long is the supervised release attached to a sentence?
It would be 3 years.
3 years.
Yes. And that would have started the end of November of 2009 when he was released from federal custody.
So he would be on supervised release until 2012, roughly?
Yes. That would be correct. So that's the only condition. And that's inadequate in our position. In reviewing the facts, I'll look at the mitigation that the board found. And the first two paragraphs of the mitigation deal with his disease of leukemia. And it's unfortunate to have that kind of a diagnosis. I think that played a big role, perhaps, in what the trial judge did in sentencing. And that's a different issue that I'll address later. But under our rules and regulations, the only two health issues, if you will, that we deal with are either mental health issues or substance abuse slash alcoholism. Why the board deals with two paragraphs with leukemia, I'm not sure, but we suggest that that is not a proper mitigating factor in this particular case. The second thing that they indicate is that he cooperated with authorities, and I don't disagree that he did cooperate with authorities after conviction. There was a transition period when apparently a bankruptcy trustee took over. There were some issues that needed help, and he cooperated with that. I don't call that cooperation with authorities. The cooperators were the ones who worked for Berkeley Nutrapharmaceuticals, who realized that they were the subjects or targets of the federal investigation, went to the government, confessed their guilt, if you will, entered into cooperation agreements and plea agreements, and testified on behalf of the government. That is cooperating with authorities. Post-conviction, that's really amelioration or mitigation, not true cooperation. So we discount that particular aspect of it. Major problem that we have is his acceptance of responsibility. It is our position that he has not truly accepted responsibility. The two primary matters, and the respondent calls them distinct and discrete incidents, and that's if you look at a vacuum. Yes, there were two specific events that he was convicted of. One deals with the Food and Drug Administration investigation. where it was testified to a trial by one of the workers, whose name I believe was Greg, that Paul told me to get rid of it, meaning get rid of misbranded drugs so the FDA, when they came on an inspection that the respondent was well aware of, get it out of the way so that, the government would not find it. That, to me, is obstruction of the administration of justice. Be that as may, at the panel hearing, and I'll have to look for the quote so I don't say it incorrectly, respondent testified, Greg said, I told Paul about the misbranded Rovacid, and he said, get rid of it. That's the quote from the testimony. Respondent goes on and says, which could be possible, but I don't specifically remember ever making that comment, but I definitely would never have told someone to hide it. If you made that comment, if you sat through a trial, witnesses said, this is what you said, this is what you told me to do, and I did it, accepting responsibility says, yes, I did it. It's not equivocating, saying, I might have said it, but I don't think I would have said it, but I sure wouldn't have told him to hide it. Now, I don't know which one is worse, hide it or get rid of it. Bottom line is the government's looking to see whether or not these are bad products that would go to the consumer, and you do anything that's inappropriate.
So, counsel, we are here to discuss, I guess, the propriety of a disbarment versus a 2-year suspension.
Yes, ma'am. Correct?
Now, my concern is that the respondent is going to be on probation from the federal system until, looks like, November of 2012.
Yes.
And I guess that there is the potential here that we invoke a 2-year suspension, but don't start that until he is finished with complying with all the terms of his probation, which would effectively cause him to be out of the practice until maybe 2014?
Correct.
Is that a middle ground that you would find acceptable?
I was concerned I would be asked a question like that.
I'm glad I didn't disappoint.
Well, it's because, personally, I could see that as a reasonable compromise. Quite candidly, I think an indefinite suspension probably fits here. But our position is still permanent disbarment because of prior case law from this court and what we think the facts will do it. I always hate being candid with the court, but I think I have that responsibility. So whether the bar agrees with what I just said or not, I'll take that consequence back in Cincinnati.
Counsel, on the there are two different things involved here. One is this product that was
correct
in the warehouse. And exactly what is it that he said or instructed somebody to do?
The trial testimony from the worker named Greg, and I'm sorry, I forget his last name, was, Paul told me to get rid of it.
Okay.
You can take that into two different contexts. If you look at the totality of the circumstances, it was known that the FDA was coming to check for misbranded products. I am presuming, because I wasn't at the trial, that Rovacid, whatever it is, was a misbranded product. And for whatever reason, they didn't want FDA to find it because there would be fines and all the rest of that.
Okay.
So it would.
Was it established, though, by misbranding? I guess I don't know what that means. Does it mean the wrong label is on it?
I'll go back to my old pharmacy days. It can mean any number of things. One, it's the wrong label on the wrong product. Or two, you're supposed to have aspirin in it and you've got Tylenol in it. That's, you know, the wrong ingredient. So it could be either one.
And
of those.
Do we know, was the product sitting there just because nobody had, in other words, nobody was going to try to sell it or move it into the marketplace and it just hadn't been dumped? Or was it that it was awaiting to be repackaged so it was correctly labeled? Do we know any of?
I can't answer that. I have not reviewed the entire trial transcript. I'll interpret.
It would be one matter if they were just trying to hide something. They were still going to try and unload it on the public in a misbranded form. It's another matter if it's sitting there on a pallet waiting to have a proper disposition. And you know the feds are coming and say, geez, you know, that's crap's still sitting out there, we need to get rid of it.
And what you say then when the feds come in is you say, we have this drug here, we have realized that it is misbranded, it is on the way for destruction. That's how you get rid of a misbranded, mislabeled product. You don't take it out of the warehouse, put it over here in warehouse B, and as soon as the feds have left the front door, bring it back in the back, and that's what happened.
Okay, that's what happened, but right. Is that what he instructed the folks at the warehouse to do?
I can only go by what was testified to, was he told a worker to get rid of it.
And did they?
They did. They took it out the back door. When the FDA left, they brought it back into the warehouse. It was hidden, essentially, from the government to inspect.
But that was a subject matter of the conviction in federal court.
One of them, the obstruction with regard to the FDA.
We're not here to second guess right. whether he legitimately should have been convicted in federal court of no. the obstruction. That's not our concern.
No, Judge Spiegel, when there was a motion for acquittal filed by the respondent, went through a lengthy opinion, finding there was more than adequate evidence to show that the convictions all will stand.
And then he did something with respect to these trusts, right?
With regard to the trust, that's another factor that was known to the respondent, that the FTC was seeking money for settlement. There was apparently a number of class action lawsuits filed, and there was a settlement agreement. The FTC, Federal Trade Commission, was going to look for money. And knowing that, and knowing that there was, what at some point I saw the language you used earlier, a window of opportunity, that's when the trust agreements were created. Our problem with the respondent on the trust agreements is he keeps saying it's the other guys that did it. It's the estate person who advised Mr. Warshak he need to do some trust stuff, and then the lawyers, the Venable firm in Washington, they wrote it. All I did was look at it to make sure it complied with Ohio law. Well, all I did to make sure it complied with Ohio law was make sure it worked. That's the net result. And when you know that there is an investigation into the finances of the company, and when you know, or at least at the very minimum should know, there's something funny going on here, because he's already dealt with the Better Business Bureau starting a year before this came down, that's a deception, that's a fraud. Once again, thwarting the administration, because $14 million moved. Granted, he didn't move the money himself, but had he not approved the trust agreements and said, yes, they comply with Ohio law, none of that would have happened.
Counsel, that puzzles me a little bit. If he's culpable in that regard, why was an outside counsel that specifically drafted it for that purpose also culpable?
My best supposition is that there was understanding between the government and that firm for cooperation, because they came and testified also at the trial.
Okay. That helps answer that question.
Yeah.
Did your brief contains documents or a statement that Mr. Kellogg participated in a conspiracy to defraud customers of over $400 million?
That's the general conspiracy.
Pardon me, please?
That's the general conspiracy. The first count of the indictment was a general conspiracy, and nobody really knows if it's $400 million or more, quite frankly. But that was a language from Judge Spiegel at the time that I believe he was sentencing, that he was convicted of the money laundering conspiracies which involved that $400 million. I'm not about to say that he personally was involved in the $400 million, but he was convicted involving that. Did that make sense to you, Your Honor?
And your recommendation here is, with respect to a sentence, you're seeking a disbarment.
Yes.
Based on what precedent from this court are you relying on?
Judge, there's any number of cases that we have had federal money laundering convictions where there has been a permanent disbarment. We've cited some of those in our brief. The difficulty with doing that is because it's discretionary with this court in a manner of speaking. We don't have a bright line, and hopefully we never do have a bright line. Each case should be judged on its own. But we think the facts of this case are adequate for the permanent disbarment.
Thank you.
He hasn't accepted responsibility. The other one point I want to mention is there is some talk about he did not appeal, and I want to be sure the court knows that had he appealed, first of all, probably wouldn't have won. Judge Spiegel dealt with the weight and sufficiency But then the government would have cross-appealed, and he was originally looking at 235 to 293 months. Probation recommendation was 188 months, and trial court gave him a year and a day, which effectively is 10 and a half months. The government cross-appeals to Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals may well have sent it back for resentencing. It would have been substantially better, or worser, I guess you would say it, a higher number, to say the least. Unless there's other questions, I think I've exhausted my time.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenwald.
Thank you.
Mr. Fleischer.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Jim Fleischer. I'm here today on behalf of the respondent, Paul Kellogg, who is seated behind counsel table. And we are here, Your Honor, to respectfully request that the court adopt the findings of the Board of Commissioners, the findings of fact, the conclusions of law, and the proposed sanction that the panel unanimously recommended to the board on December 4 of 2009. The panel conducted a two-day hearing in this matter. The first day of the hearing comprised of listening to two character witnesses who testified on behalf of Mr. Kellogg. In addition to that, a variety of documents were submitted. Those documents included portions of the trial transcript and sentencing transcripts that were submitted by the respondent, in addition to a vast number of character references and letters that were submitted by attorneys, physicians, various people that knew Paul Kellogg and that comprised or composed those letters after becoming aware of the circumstances of his convictions.
Counsel, you are asking for a two-year suspension to be imposed, starting when?
Your Honor, we would submit that the panel's or the board's recommendation of it, that suspension commencing on January 15, 2009 would be appropriate. I would note for the court that Mr. Kellogg's sentencing occurred on August 29 of 2008. 3 days later, he self-reported to the disciplinary council. This is after a weekend. Self-reported to the disciplinary council and the Cincinnati Bar Association and voluntarily suspended his practice of law immediately, starting on September 2 of 2008, and notified, I believe, disciplinary council of his intent to do so. There were obviously the interim suspension in this case did not become imposed until roughly, I think, December 14 of 2009. But for that entire period of time, Mr. Kellogg was not practicing law. Now, admittedly, a portion of that time he was in the Ashland Correctional Facility and was unable to. But the balance of that time he also
did not. When did he enter the facility?
Your Honor, I believe it was January 15 of 2009, and that was the basis for the board's recommendation that it commence on that date.
Counsel, when is his probation up?
Your Honor, as I understand it, he was released. He had a 12-month sentence, 12-month and one day, which is significant, as we pointed out in our briefs. He was released in August of 2009. His sentence, though, didn't actually terminate until, I believe, November of 2009, as Mr. Rosenwald has indicated. His 3 years of supervised release, as I understand it, won't terminate until November of 2012.
That's a concern. I believe that if we were to accept the board's recommendation, January 15th, 2009 is where they suggest the two-year suspension begin, which means we'd have more than a year with your client, if we accepted their recommendation, allowed to practice while on federal probation.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand that. It would help to point out Judge Spiegel's apparent perspective on some of this in light of his sentencing decisions and what he permitted Mr. Kellogg to do after his conviction. After the jury returned verdicts in this case in February of 2008. Judge Spiegel, Senior Judge Spiegel in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District, permitted two of the defendants, to return to Berkeley Premium Nutraceuticals to assist in the operation of the company. One of those individuals was Mr. Kellogg. Respondents Exhibit J that was submitted to the panel is a letter from Rick Nelson, who's an attorney in Cincinnati, Ohio, at Cohen, Todd, Kite, and Stanford. Mr. Nelson submitted an affidavit, and that affidavit indicated that Mr. Kellogg was cooperative, helpful, and in assisting him with the operation of the company. It was significant because the company had obviously undergone serious federal convictions, and ultimately Mr. Nelson was appointed as the bankruptcy trustee. He was initially the court-appointed monitor.
Counsel, I think what we're concerned about is having an officer of the court out there practicing while they've got federal or even state probation hanging over their head. Is that a legitimate concern for this court?
Obviously, I think it is a legitimate concern, Your Honor. I think it can be, should be considered in light of the terms of his supervised release. Mr. Kellogg, as I understand it, is simply required to report to a probation officer on a periodic basis. It is not a, a particularly onerous set of conditions that are upon him. The supervised release would not interfere with his ability to practice law, and I understand the court's concern. I think that it is something that would need to be reported to his probation officer and then through to Judge Spiegel, and I believe that the judge would likely have the ability to add a condition of supervised release if he did not believe
here's the practice. Here's the problem for us. Over the course of looking at, and this is a matter that's evolving as you stand in front of us, over the course of considering a number of cases where there has been a finding of criminal guilt, and there is usually a probation period, this court is moving toward the notion that one should not be allowed to practice, that it just looks wrong, is wrong, while you're under probation. Now, we're having a lively internal debate as to whether or not we should move there, because it could have an unintended consequence that if we make that in every case, that judges who are sentencing lawyers might look at it and say, well, I won't have an extended period of probation, even though this is a person due to drugs and alcohol that needs it so that they can get back in the practice because the Supreme Court won't allow them. But that's a debate we're having, and you've seen it imposed now in a few cases that are out there. We haven't really instructed the board that they need to do that yet, and we're not settled on it. So your insight into
Your Honor, into
that question would be helpful to us, because nobody's argued that yet to us one way or the other.
I would cite a particular example. My insight is limited based primarily on federal criminal practice, and I do understand that obviously, in federal criminal practice, oftentimes, after the date of the verdicts and then the ultimate conviction, there can be an extended period of time where a defendant is waiting to be sentenced, waiting to obviously go through an appeal, which Mr. Kellogg elected to forego. That can take several years, and then the supervised release terms are oftentimes lengthier than 3 years in the federal system. So I would only submit to the court, based on my experience, that there may be an issue in particular with federal defendants or attorneys that have gone through the federal process where that will be a particularly onerous condition if it's imposed.
It's onerous to the lawyer.
Correct.
But there is also the view strongly articulated by some members of this court that it just doesn't look right to the public to have someone who's under the clutches of a judge for a criminal sentence serving a term of probation being allowed to practice law. And we're not running out of lawyers, so that's a perception issue that this court's gravely concerned about.
And I understand that concern, Your Honor. Senior Judge Spiegel did not address that issue in particular, but I would direct the court's attention to his approach in Mr. Kellogg's case. As the court is aware, the proposed sentence in this case under the sentencing guidelines was extremely significant. Judge Spiegel, in his sentencing entry and in his sentencing decision, determined that Mr. Kellogg should serve a sentence of 1 year and 1 month, and stated in...
Well, but these are matters, I mean, it's one issue, I mean, it's a separate issue as to how long someone who may be on the fringes of a huge case like this is, should be locked up, and they're a productive citizen, they have a family, they have health issues, and a variety of things that go into the question of how long they should be locked up. People such as your client are obviously bright, capable, and can do other things other than practice law. And so we have to weigh that. And we have, by the way, tacked on this requirement for people who weren't here arguing the case. And in other words, it came to us with neither side objecting, and when it left us, the period of time they were going to be out was extended on out until the probation ended. So we have done it in a few cases. We're doing it more.
Your Honor, there is also the issue, I suppose, of whether the respondent in this case or a respondent in a case involving federal supervised release can petition the federal court for that supervised release to be terminated early in some instances. So that may afford some type of practical consideration for the court.
And that was one of my next question, was the potential for petitioning for early release from probation, which would mitigate towards the compromise position that I discussed with opposing counsel, and that's an indefinite suspension until there is a reapplication or an application with the court. And if the attorney, and I'm not just saying this for your case and your client, with an indefinite as opposed to a permanent disbarment, which is what is being advocated here, allows them to take care of a good showing, a termination of probation on an early basis, and all of the other necessary, keeping up with your CLEs, et cetera, to make the case for reentry into the ability, with this court to practice law. It seems to me that that's a pretty reasonable approach to how this court should take a look at these cases. What's your comment on that?
Your Honor, I would never disagree with anything that a justice tells me is reasonable.
Feel free.
But I understand that concern. Obviously, it's of grave concern to this court, the public perception of having an attorney who is on some form of supervised release to be practicing law. I believe that this court has indicated that the primary reason that these disciplinary rules are implemented is to protect the public. I do not believe that the facts of this case indicate that Mr. Kellogg is a threat to the public. Just Judge Spiegel indicated in his sentencing comments that Mr. Kellogg specifically, along with some other defendants, posed very little threat of any recidivism. But I don't know how to get around the issue in this case, Your Honor. He will, at this point, be on supervised release until November of 2012, so the effective result of a decision to either do an indefinite suspension and wait for that to terminate or to impose a two-year suspension but make it effective, I suppose, or not let that two-year suspension terminate until the end of his supervised release. Means to November 2012 at this point for Mr. Kellogg. I would like to address
Mr. Fleischer, could you explain, you said he will be on until that date. Are you saying there's a reason that there might not, that he would not be able to, in his particular case, ask for a quicker termination of his probation?
Your Honor, as I stand here right now, I do not know for certain whether or not there is a statutorily mandated minimum term of supervised release for Mr. Kellogg that was imposed, or if Judge Spiegel had the ability to issue a shorter term of supervised release that would therefore enable him to reduce the term.
Thank you.
A few issues that were raised, one by Justice Cupp, I believe, to Mr. Rosenwald. I just wanted to clarify, Your Honor, with respect to the trusts that were Mr. Kellogg was involved in, Judge Spiegel found very clearly that it was September of 2004 when Mr. Kellogg became involved in the whole trust execution process. The evidence that was in the record in this case is that in July of 2004, attorneys at Venable, who had been assisting the corporation in regulatory compliance issues, which was their primary specialty, it was Ben Civiletti's firm at one time, provided advice and to Mr. Warshak, the owner of the corporation, to create those trusts. They drafted the trust. The individual who did it was actually a very well-regarded attorney, Christopher Sega, who was the ABA chair of the Fiduciary Income Tax Committee at that time. And it was indicated that Mr. Sega testified at trial and may have cooperated with the government. It's I represented Mr. Kellogg at the criminal level. Mr. Sega testified in an evidentiary hearing after being subpoenaed by Mr. Kellogg's counsel. He did not testify at the trial itself, and there was no indication that he cooperated. In fact, some of Mr. Kellogg's post-conviction cooperation efforts involved that very issue. Judge Spiegel had the same concerns that Your Honor indicated and asked the government.
Is this individual licensed in Ohio, or where is he licensed?
He's licensed in Washington, D.C., Your Honor, is my understanding. And he came and did, in fact, testify.
Okay. So it's the Cincinnati Bar did not give him a pass.
No, sir.
They can't reach him.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the state of Ohio didn't give him a pass either.
All right.
I just wanted to clarify that. I see that my time, I believe, is up. If there are any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But if not, we would ask that the court consider, in Mr. Kellogg's specific case, that the board's recommendations are appropriate. This is a case with an unusual amount of mitigating and extenuating circumstances that the board pointed to. They heard his testimony, and they saw what Judge Spiegel did in this case, and we'd ask that this court adopt that recommended
Thank you,
sanction.
Mr. Fleischer.
Thank you.
Mr. Rosenwald, you saved 6 seconds of your time. It takes 30.
I'll wait. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.